Thanks very much, Phil. So as Phil says, I'm Derek Murray. I work on the Google Brain team. And today I'm going to talk about TensorFlow, which is a project that we've been doing to build to unify various forms of machine learning on top of a single flexible platform. All right, before we begin, TensorFlow is joint work with my 21 co-authors here, with the dozens of people who have joined the TensorFlow team since we began originally released the project, and with hundreds of external contributors. It's a really big project. So TensorFlow powers a few Google services you might have heard of, including something called RankBrain, which helps to rank your search results, SmartReply, which generates automatic responses to your email messages, and Google Photos, which uses image recognition to organize your photographs. It's also open source, so you can try it for yourself. If you hear this talk and you think, psh, I can do way better than this, please download it, try it out, and hopefully you'll be up on this stage next year instead of me. So to motivate things, there are three main types of machine learning work that we care about at Google. The first, and probably the most familiar to this crowd, is large-scale training. That's you taking huge data sets, using a lot of computers to generate machine learning models. But there's the second kind of work involves taking these models and pushing them into production. So maybe this means running them in a low-latency service, like we do for web ranking, or maybe it means scaling them down and running them on a mobile device for offline use, like we do with translation. And then the third kind of work is machine learning research, which often involves taking radically different model architectures or training algorithms and using them to test out new ideas that will hopefully become tomorrow's production models. So what's the problem that we set out to solve? Well, the problem is that no one system supported these three kinds of work. For large-scale training, we had a system called Disbelief that came out about 5 years ago and is able to train deep neural networks using hundreds of machines. But Disbelief doesn't scale down to the production inference case. So our colleagues would end up creating these custom bespoke systems in order to handle inference on mobile devices and in the web services. And it wasn't flexible enough for machine learning research. So our colleagues would end up using these more powerful single machine frameworks like Theano and Torch that provide more control over the learning process. So we'd see our colleagues having to redo their work three times. First, with one of these single machine frameworks to do their research. Then they'd have to write it again in Disbelief to scale it out for large-scale training. And then finally have to write a whole new system to put their system, their model into production. So TensorFlow is the system that we designed to solve this problem. In this talk, I'm going to give a very high-level overview of what TensorFlow is and how it solves that problem. Then I'll talk about some of the things we've done with it and some of the work still to do. Okay, so first thing we needed was a common way to write programs that worked for all these use cases. And we settled, if the name wasn't a clue enough, we settled on a data flow approach. It captures a lot of the model structure we're seeing in modern machine learning algorithms like deep neural networks that have many, many different layers. And data flow also makes it relatively easy to map a computation down onto different architectures or distributed settings. So we typically write these programs in Python using a library of standard math operators. There's a few things I want to point out as we build up these graphs. The first is that TensorFlow graphs can have mutable state. This typically represents model parameters that are being trained over time in an iterative training process. The second thing is that the model architecture itself is built out of simple primitive mathematical operators like matrix multiplications, convolutions, and things like that. This line here actually hides a lot of detail, but essentially what it's doing for you is that the system can work out the set of updates that you need to make to the state in order to minimize some objective function called loss here, or you can think of it as an error term. I'm not going to explain how this works because I'd probably get it wrong, but basically what it's doing is applying high school calculus mechanically for you so that you don't need to remember all the derivations. And then finally, when you actually want to do something, you create a TensorFlow session and you tell it to run parts of your data flow graph. And this highlights probably the biggest trade-off we've made in terms of performance. We assume that this data flow graph is mostly static so that TensorFlow can amortize the cost of doing relatively expensive optimizations on the graph across a large number of executions. So how would we take one of these programs and run it on a cluster for large-scale training? So an approach we'd like to support is the parameter server architecture. It worked very well for us in Disbelief. And if you remember from OSDI 2014, there were a couple of papers, one called the parameter server, one called Project Adam, that used the same approach to good effect. So to recap how this works, in parameter server, as you have two sets of processes. The first are the parameter servers themselves. These work kind of like a distributed key value store, holding the state of your training program, that is the model parameters. And then the workers are geared for computation. So they typically have powerful CPUs and accelerators like general purpose GPUs that will do the high throughput mathematical computations. So a worker will drive the training process, reading a batch of data from disk, calling get on the parameter server to read the next current values of the parameters. Then it spends some time crunching numbers, finally computing a set of parameter updates that it will send back to the parameter server in this put call. And unlike a conventional key value store, this put call is a commutative update. It's something like an assign add or an assign subtract or maybe something more complicated. But the point is it has to be commutative so that multiple workers can be calling put on the parameter servers at the same time. And no matter the order, you'll end up with roughly the same result. So how does TensorFlow take this program and run it across multiple processes? Well, instead of making a hard partitioning between the computation and the state, TensorFlow takes the entire data flow graph that represents the computation and partitions it across a set of tasks. So instead of having distinct implementations for parameter servers and for workers, we have a single TensorFlow task service that can execute cached graphs with low latency, dispatch them to local accelerators, and communicate with other services as necessary. And the great thing about data flow for this problem is that the edges tell you exactly what communication you need. So partitioning the graph across these tasks is relatively straightforward. For example, you put the matrix multiplications on a worker with a GPU. We put the variables and the operations that update those variables on the PS tasks so that they're shared between the workers. And wherever an edge crosses between two processes, or in general between two devices, TensorFlow steps in and adds the appropriate message passing or coordination. And the key idea of this system is that TensorFlow uses these stateful data flow graphs to represent all of the computation in a machine learning algorithm. That includes the mutable state and all the operations that act upon it. This gives programmers a lot of flexibility because they can simulate existing architectures like parameter servers, but they can also take the same program and run it on a mobile device for inference or on their local workstation for doing some research. And while I only showed one example of the distributed execution, TensorFlow supports other distributed setups. So, for example, if you want to cut out the parameter servers altogether, you can have direct worker-to-worker communication, holding state on the workers, and use something like an optimized all-reduce to make things faster. So this data flow gives us a lot of flexibility. I want to show you a couple of examples of how we exploited this in the context of large-scale training. And the first case has to do with parameter synchronization. If you've watched a talk on distributed machine learning in the last 5 years, someone will probably have told you that to scale out distributed machine learning across a large number of machines, you have to accept a reduction in consistency and run in an asynchronous mode. And the reason for this is that it's great for utilization. Your workers can read parameters as soon as they become idle, they can send back results as soon as they're done, and they never have to block on another slow worker or a straggler. But the problem comes when a worker sends back updates based on an old version of the parameters. Remember, I said that this put operation is a commutative write, so we're applying gradients or something computed in an old version of the world to a new copy of the state, and those gradients might not move the state in the right direction. So we have to make our algorithms more conservative to deal with this, turning down learning rates and things like that. And that caused us to think, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could just run this as if it was one big synchronous high-performance computer? And we recognize that networks are getting faster, that GPUs mean you don't need hundreds of workers always to train a machine learning model. So we thought, well, can we change the graph so that it does synchronous training? And in this setup, it's pretty straightforward. All the workers read their parameters in lockstep. They compute for a while on independent batches of data and then send back their results. But those results are only applied and aggregated at the parameter server when the last worker sends back its update. This means that all workers are working on the same copy of the state, but we're accepting a decrease in utilization because now if we have a slow worker, it's going to hold up the training process and our utilization is going to drop. So how does this look in practice? Well, we measured how well the asynchronous and synchronous approaches scaled up to 200 machines when training the inception image model. On this graph, higher is better, and as you would expect, the synchronous approach had lower overall throughput by about 10%. But we were still drawn to the synchronous approach because it has the potential to be more robust to inconsistencies in training and to scale to more different algorithms. So we thought about it for a while. And we realized that instead of running in lockstep across n workers, we could add k backup workers into the mix. And then all n plus k workers would read the parameters at the beginning of the step, they'd work on independent batches of data, and when the first n complete their work, we could apply the update and move on to the next step. This cuts out the k slowest workers from the tail, and it ought to improve the overall throughput while providing the same semantics as synchronous training. To have a look at how it does, when we ran inception training for n equals 50 and increased k, the number of backup workers, from 0 to 4, you see the step time drop from a median of 2.26 seconds down to 1.94 seconds. But this speed up isn't free. We're occupying k additional GPUs and throwing away the results. So one of the things we looked at was what is the normalized speed up? If we discount the speed up we get by a factor of n over n plus k, we can see that with k equals 3 backup workers, we get a 10% normalized speed up that reclaims almost all of the difference in performance between synchronous and asynchronous while reducing the number of total GPU seconds used from the synchronous case. All right, another issue I want to talk about is training models on very high dimensional data. So in this case, we want to make some predictions based on text or based on URLs or the names of online videos or something like that. And the standard approach for dealing with this kind of high dimensional data is to use an embedding matrix that can map the high dimensional data down into a set of dense vectors. The approach is quite simple. You map each token to a different row in the matrix, and then you aggregate the values for the rows that each example corresponds to, effectively doing a sparse matrix multiplication between the input data and the embedding matrix. And the nice thing about this is that you can learn the weights in the embedding matrix using the same techniques that we use to learn the weights in other parts of a neural network. So in principle, this is quite a simple idea. But in practice, the embedding matrix can be absolutely huge. It can have hundreds of thousands of rows if you're representing English language data, but far more if it represents different web pages or videos or that sort of thing. So one approach we tried out was to build a distributed sparse matrix multiplication into the data flow graph. This is how it looks. So you start with some sparse data in the form of lists of integers. You partition the embedding matrix across a set of PS tasks. You shard the indices by the same partitioning function that you use to shard the embedding matrix, and then you perform some aggregation at the PS task and a final aggregation at the worker to get a set of dense vectors that you can then feed into the next step of your learning algorithm. So this is useful for mapping down sparse input data. It can also be useful in other cases. I'd encourage you to have a look at the paper where we talk about how this same subgraph approach can be used to implement something called candidate sampling, which deals with predicting classifications based on very large output spaces. And this is very useful for generating language data, for example. Okay, so now I want to spend the rest of the talk talking about some of the open research challenges that we face. I'm going to focus on the ones that are more relevant to the systems crowd. So in general, data flow satisfies our goals for flexibility because we can map it down onto different sets of devices, and it provides all of the right hooks that we need to achieve excellent performance. But sometimes you really need to be an expert. You need to be someone who developed the system in order to get that performance. So there's a kind of an ease of use factor that's missing. And I think a little bit of fundamental research can help with this. So the first problem that we face is how to do device placement. So data flow, I said earlier, is great as a mechanism because it makes it very easy to say, I'm going to map these nodes to that device and these other nodes to another device, and it will work out all the communication that needs to be added to your program. But if you have a small graph of, say, 5 nodes here, there are 32 different ways that you can lay them out across 2 GPUs. And in a real TensorFlow graph, you have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of nodes to make that decision about. So how do we deal with this exponential complexity? I fear you're going to be disappointed, but the answer is we use some really simple heuristics to deal with this. We take all the mutable state and assign it round robin across different PS tasks. All the stateless parts, we replicate to all of the worker tasks and put as much logic as possible onto a single GPU. The remainder that can't run on the GPU goes on a local CPU, and hopefully that part isn't performance critical. In general, this works for models that fit in a single GPU, but as models are growing, this is not always going to be possible. So automatic placement is this sort of unicorn dream that we have where we can optimize the overall performance of training a model by solving a lot of other optimization problems. We want to minimize the amount of time spent copying data across interconnects, minimize the amount of time that runnable operations spend queuing for a busy device. We want to balance the I/O bandwidth so that training data is being read in at the same rate as it's being consumed. And we want to do this, all this while satisfying the constraints at memory at each individual device. So we'd really benefit from an automated solution to this problem. I'm not aware of one that works at the scale of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of nodes. Perhaps some one of you in the audience does and can suggest it, and we'll be glad to suggest it in the Q&A. But if you have an idea that could help us with this approach, we'd be very, very grateful to learn about it. Okay, a second challenge is how to take advantage of the data flow representation to generate more efficient code. So data flow graphs look a lot like the internal representations of compilers. And we take advantage of this fact in a few ways. We do all of the simple compiler optimizations, things like common sub-expression elimination, constant folding, dead code elimination. And when we have a graph that's built up out of lots of simple primitive operators, you have a lot of opportunities to apply these optimizations. So that works out really great. But if you pull back the curtains a bit and look in the TensorFlow code base, you'll see that we don't always build up our models out of simple primitive operations. There are things with sort of strangely Teutonic sounding names like softmax cross entropy with logits that are actually a fusion of 12 different operators into one kernel. And we lump these together for performance reasons. We don't want to pay the overhead of dispatching lots of small operations, and we don't want the memory cost of materializing intermediate results and consuming the memory bandwidth to write these out to memory and read them back in. So right now we're working on automatic kernel fusion so that you can take a graph like the one on the left and fuse it into one big kernel. And doing this kind of fusion is a no-brainer when you have a single device like a GPU. But when you have multiple devices, like we do in the more general case, it actually reduces your options, because now you have a tension between the amount of fusion that you do for efficiency and the amount of concurrency you can get in execution. So one of the things we'd really like to discover is some kind of compiler optimization that takes into account the idea of offloading computation to many different possible devices and dovetails with this to-be-decided policy for automated device placement. Okay, so that was a whirlwind tour of TensorFlow. I'm just about out of time. To wrap up, TensorFlow achieves the flexibility that we sought for machine learning by using data flow graphs as a common programming model. So now our users can write a single program, run it on their local workstation for research, scale it out to train on a cluster on large-scale data, and then scale it back down to run in production inference on a mobile device or on a back-end service. I showed you a couple of ways that we exploited this flexibility and hopefully piqued your curiosity by talking about a couple of potential research challenges. So as I mentioned earlier, all the code is open source. You can download it from this website, tensorflow.org, and I would love to take your questions now or discuss it more at the poster session.
Hello, Heidi from UIUC. I have a question about different channels being used in TensorFlow. So in general, you have two different data channels. One between devices you have, like different GPUs want to share data, and one between a parameter server and TensorFlow. Yeah. And since TensorFlow used gRPC, there is little possibility of optimizing this gather-scatter operation between parameter servers and devices. How would you incorporate different type of hardware, network hardware, with this architecture?
Right, that's a really good question. So as you correctly observe, in the version of TensorFlow that we released, we use RPC to do the communication between various different processes in the cluster. And it's not particularly specialized. It doesn't really take advantage of fancy hardware like InfiniBand or RDMA or things like that. That is an area that we're looking at. So what there is in TensorFlow is this ability to specialize the send and receive operations that are inserted into the graph when we partition it. Right now, the one we have uses gRPC, but it'd be totally possible to use point-to-point MPI operations or maybe even collective operations like an all reduce to optimize that. As for the scatter gather, I think our philosophy would be more you would encode that scatter gather as nodes in the graph so that you would do some control transfer using the same point-to-point message passing. and use that to encode the things like we do for the sparse matrix optimizations. All right, thank you.